Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. On the show tonight,
I am living proof of Illinois making good on its promise.
I check in on whether Illinois is living up to its pledge to bring social equity to the cannabis industry.
I campaigned on clarifications that needed to be made to the Safety Act.
Our Spotlight Politics team on why the governor signed those changes quietly.
The arts community reacts to AI-generated portraits that are taking over social media by storm.
The moon is about to make Mars disappear. No, it's not a magic act. We explain how and whether you'll be able to see it.
When it comes to the horses, I feel like they're also another part of your motivation.
We take you inside a boxing club in Little Village, teaching kids skills in and out of the ring.
You ever feel those people inching towards you? You're just like, get the hell away from me.
Chicago comedian Pat McGann on being a latecomer to stand up and playing the iconic Chicago theater.
Come as you are. You know, you don't need the necessary to understand music.
And meet the newest guest conductor with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
But first, some of today's top stories. An investigation is underway in the death of a 21-year-old pulled from Lake Michigan earlier today. The body was identified as Poland native Krzysztof Schubert, who was missing since Saturday night. Schubert's co-workers say they last saw him at Howl at the Moon in River North before he showed up unresponsive at Oak Street Beach today. Though the cause of death remains unknown, there have been 43 Lake Michigan drownings so far this year, 15 of them off Chicago's shoreline. That's according to the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project.
A surprise announcement from the vice president of Chicago's Board of Education. Senthil Rivaluri says he's stepping down from the position after more than 3 years. Rivaluri was appointed to the position in 2019 by Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Rivaluri is the fourth person to leave the board this year. Chicago Public Schools has been the lone district in Illinois with a school board appointed by the mayor, but under legislation signed into law last year, the Board of Ed will transition into an elected board beginning in 2024.
A record number of people were sworn in as U.S. citizens today at Wintrust Arena. There were nearly 2,000 people representing 120 countries, according to the U.S. District Court, making it the largest naturalization ceremony held at Wintrust. Meanwhile, records were broken on the national level as well. The U.S. reported more than 1 million naturalizations for the 2022 fiscal year. That's the highest annual number of citizens naturalized since 2008, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Coming up in the program, controversy over art made by artificial intelligence.
But first, is the state bringing social equity to the cannabis industry? We check in right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
A black-owned cannabis dispensary is open in Chicago, but nearly 200 other shops that won license to operate have yet to open their doors. Amanda Vinicky joined us now with a look at whether Illinois is following through on promises to use legal marijuana to lift communities and people who were previously punished by anti-pot laws. Amanda.
Well, Paris, it has been nearly 3 years since Illinois legalized marijuana, and only just now are black and brown-owned businesses opening, like Ivy Hall in Bucktown. Co-owner Nigel Danbridge says being the first social equity cannabis dispensary to open in Illinois is momentous. History in the making.
I am living proof of Illinois making good on its promise to carve out a more equitable cannabis landscape for generations to come. Yet again, Illinois is out ahead of the pack.
Governor J.B. Pritzker says Ivy Hall is evidence of Illinois following through on its pledge of using the state's authority to prioritize helping those previously persecuted in the war on drugs.
As we've promised from day one, Illinois has the most accessible and equitable cannabis industry in the nation, even with its hiccups or legal obstacles. And as the first of 192 social equity licensees to launch, Ivy Hall is paving the way for even more success in this new industry.
Except Ambrose Jackson doesn't think that's how it will go. He also won a state social equity license to open a dispensary, but he expects it won't open until next summer. Jackson says there's stratification among the 192 social equity licensees. The couple that are opening likely already had a lot of capital and connections, he says. Then there's a tier of businesses like his. He says with owners that have the know-how but are having to go slower because after years of delays, they don't have the cash. Then come those he predicts will never open.
What I see is that there's a number of reasons why the majority of license winners are not going to become operational, and it's disingenuous for the state or the governor to herald success based off of who initially won these licenses without thinking about what's being done to make sure that they actually stand them up and are successful and sustainable businesses.
I asked the governor today whether he expects all of the groups that won those coveted and expensive social equity licenses to open.
I'm hopeful that that's the case. And we're certainly doing everything that we can, providing loans to folks who need them. They're forgivable loans, making sure that we're helping them through the process as best we can. So I'm hopeful that we're going to see nearly all. I mean, I know small businesses are very hard to start.
Now, the main reason that these licenses have been tied up for years is because of lawsuits. Now, regardless of the cause, though, Jackson says the wait caused huge financial harm to social equity entrepreneurs. In that time, some lost partners, real estate, and investors that instead went to other businesses in other states. With COVID, higher interest rates leading to higher borrowing costs and stock shares and pot companies falling, the market, he says, is much different than it was back in 2020.
100%, the state has not followed through on its pledge or promise as it relates to social equity in this industry.
Jackson says the state could be doing more to help. For example, allowing those that won craft grow licenses to be allowed to open larger cultivation centers, because he says it's a challenge to secure funding for the relatively small space allowed by law. Another option, removing a requirement that cultivation centers be distanced far apart, and that way they could work together and lower overhead. But he says those requests to state lawmakers have fallen on deaf ears.
However, that's been blocked. The legislature has decided time and time again over the last couple of years through veto sessions and lame duck sessions and legislative sessions that they are not going to move on any legislation that helps social equity license winners get up and running and become successful.
The governor today said that he will work with the General Assembly on that cultivation issue. But again, that has been a request for many months and hasn't advanced at all. The state did last month make available nearly $9 million in forgivable loans to help social equity businesses that are having trouble getting off the ground.
All right, Amanda, what's next then?
Well, Paris, a new legislature is going to be seated in January, and so we'll be watching to see whether this is a priority for them. Another 55 conditional social equity licenses are yet to be awarded. Officials today offered no firm timeline for when that will happen. Some businesses are pressing for Illinois to do other things, like allowing for the delivery of marijuana, like you'd get a pizza delivered to your door. The governor today signaled an openness to that idea, but he did not outright embrace it as a priority.
Paris. All right, Amanda Vinikin, we'll see you in just a bit for Spotlight Politics. And up next, artificial intelligence meets the art world, and some say the result isn't pretty. Stay with us.
Do you think there's been sort of a rethinking of how those events happened here in Chicago?
I made a promise to myself in my career that every year I would make a piece of art dedicated to the memory.
Got into a zone of mentor to children. See what we can do to kind of elevate each other. We all we got at this point.
I'm using my past to push forward, to build a movement, to create the world that we all want to see.
You might have seen people posting artificial intelligence or AI-generated self-portraits on social media recently, including me. Here's an example. It's all done through the Lensa AI app, where for a few bucks, people can submit photos of themselves that the app will use to generate multiple self-portraits in different art styles. But it's also reignited concerns about the ethics regarding the use of artificial intelligence in art. Joining us to discuss it are Kennedy Freeman, student in fine arts at Columbia College and founder of the Black Femme Art Collective, Hour 9, Jennifer DeWinter, dean of Lewis College of Science and Letters at Illinois Tech, and Jason Salavon, associate professor in visual arts at the University of Chicago and contemporary fine artist whose art deals heavily with AI, large data, and algorithms. Thanks to the three of you for joining us. Kennedy, let's start with you, please. What was your initial reaction when you saw people posting these portraits online?
It was a little bit scary because I know AI from like my previous experience. It's a lot of compilations of artists who have made art, and it's like kind of stolen art from the internet. And as a young artist trying to like make it out here and trying to have the pressures of putting my art on social media, but there's a fear that my art's going to get stolen for these AI generators. So it's interesting how many people I saw playing into that and how many other artists as well putting their artwork out there and their AI generated portraits.
You spoke out about this on social media as well. What did you say and what led you to speak up?
I just felt like at the moment it was a bit scary, and like for the future of the art world, how already trying to break into the corporate art world is a bit hard. And so there's a way that people can pay $8 to get like so many pictures of things that you could pay an artist and ethically and not have it stolen from the internet. So I just was a bit talking about how different industries have been affected by this, like the mass consumption of various things, and people want things cheap and fast. So like how that's translating to the art world was just a bit scary for me to see.
And when you say stolen from the internet, you mean stolen of work that artists, real human
yes.
artists have completed that
yes.
has been
yeah.
available on the internet and available to see. Jennifer, can you explain how an app like Lensa can use AI to generate portraits?
Sure. So what's happening is that the algorithms are going into these large data sets. In this case, it's going into DeviantArt and online posted work like Twitter. And it's beginning to codify through formal languages what it's seeing, right? And to be clear, it's not human language, right? We're talking about an abstracted language. And so when I then send my information into an app like Lensa, what it then does is a similar sort of decoding process where it goes, well, that's a nose and that's an eye, and it's beginning to understand like what the composite parts of the picture are. So then using a translator, it translates what it sees from me and it sees what it sees from the internet, and it starts generating both the image and the textures, right? So these are two different layers that it's going to bring together. And that's why in the different styles that you're showing, you see similar types of images, but radically different types of textures or techniques showing up.
Is this a copyright issue?
Absolutely. And that's really where this challenge is coming up, right? Like, it hasn't become a copyright issue yet, because the question is really who's stealing it. So under old copyright laws, I have an image, and if I were to reproduce that image or something in the essence of an artist, there's a certain number of parts of it I have to change for it to go into fair use. And humorists have always kind of dealt with this, right? But now you have this image that goes out into the world, and it's obviously in the style of an online artist who's posted their work. But
and then the question becomes, who stole it, right?
Right?
Is it the
like,
machine, the person who made the computer?
Is it who queried it? Is the person who made the generator? Is it the person, like, is it DeviantArt who collected all the work into a single place to then be read? Is it the company that owns it? Is it the person who prints it? Like, it's a problem of a giant diffuse system of multiple actors. Who's culpable?
Jason Salavon, you've been using large data and algorithms in your artwork since the 90s. It's been some time. What do you make of AI being more widespread in the arts like this?
I think we're at the very, very beginning of AI deployed for culture. And I think if this is controversial, just wait until what's coming down the pipe. It is the case that these models ingest images from DeviantArt and images from WikiArt. They also ingest images from every photographic source in the world. There are These models are inhumanly scaled. They ingest data in the billions. So their capabilities are, and Lensa is just a small little sort of taste of what's happening right now and what's coming. So it's not just about art, or painting, it's about photography, it's about images in general and text in general, and the ability of these AI models to synthesize new samples that feel like something familiar but are novel in their own way.
Jason, what are you concerned, or what are you suggesting is coming down the pike? Some of the wider ranging impacts?
So it's both exciting and scary. Like, having been sort of in this space for so long, I'm truly sort of excited to see things really, really reaching a threshold that feels qualitatively different than sort of my experience of the last, honestly, like 30 years. But I can see, like I have a 7-year-old child, and I think about her growing up in an environment where targeted ads are synthesized specifically for her. I'm not talking about like canned advertisements that are cut and pasted together. I'm talking about an image that's made specifically based on the cookies in her browser and her own sort of behavior online. Those kinds of things start to feel a little dystopian. At the same time, I'm really excited about what's going to happen in film and television and video games and fine art. So, I have definitely ambivalence about the way AI will impact culture.
Kennedy, do you think this is all a part of an evolution in the art scene?
I'm a little so-so about it, just because I'm like, what is protecting a small artist? Say I put my work out there and somebody, some random AI artist, takes it and steals it. Like, what laws, what things are in place so that my work is protected and against my wishes? And just in general, I think it's important to protect the small artists, the people working hard to like put together like a community of like genuine, authentic art. And so it's like, at the moment, I think it's something cool and fascinating, but like down the line, how far are we going to take this, and like how can other artists be exploited, and how can we protect them?
Jennifer, as we mentioned early on, I uploaded a few of my pictures and I showed those to you before we started this segment. And there were a few in particular, I think it was the fairy tale, where my skin is noticeably lighter.
White, I would even
yes,
say.
Yes, dare I say, the whitification of Brandis. What's going on there?
Sure. Like, it has to do with the data sets that we're pulling from. So if you think about the ways in which fairy tales tend to get perpetuated in Western society, here it is, right? That they're often white, lithe, like beautiful, very skinny people, right? And so in order to build the data set of what it might translate you into, there's no data set of black fairies that's significant enough to then be translated out back into this image of yourself.
Okay. And before we let you go, very briefly, in about, 20 seconds, privacy issues here.
Sure.
Is there a bot of me in China walking around, like, just based on, I've given away my image now?
Sure. I mean, there's no mistake that this is rising up at the same time that we have concerns about deepfakes, right? There's no mistake that this is coming up right about the same time that we have concerns about biometric data, right? And that we can change a password, but if someone hacks my face in order to start accessing my iPhone or whatever, like, I can't change my face. And so all of these technologies, the anxiety that are arising around these technologies are not about this in particular, although, of course, it's concerning for artists, right? It's not about this in particular. It's about it within this milieu of almost a techno-dystopia, right? So that's where we're at.
A lot of questions and concerns. Kennedy Freeman, Jennifer DeWinter, and Jason Salvan, thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
And now to Paris and details on a disappearing planet. Paris.
Brandis, pending Chicago clouds, you might be able to spot a rarish sighting in the night sky. The moon will cover Mars, but the red planet is bright enough to peep through and presents quite a show. It's called occultation. WTTW News reporter Patty Wetley joins us now with more. Patty, I just learned a new word, occultation.
Good
what
job.
Exactly is? Thank you very much. Don't ask me to spell it. How rare are they, and what exactly is it?
So I was speaking with Michelle Nichols at the Adler Planetarium, and she said, in plain speak, occultation is when one thing in the sky passes in front of another and obscures its view. So imagine the moon passing in front of Mars and obscuring it, kind of like an eclipse. It's just kind of another word for another kind.
Yeah, I was going to say, we already have a word for that. It's called eclipse. All right.
Right.
So they're common, but why is tonight such a big deal?
Well, you know, the moon passes in front of things all the time and obscures stars. We just don't see them. Mars is one of those things in the night sky that's bright enough for us to see. You know, Think of, there's so few planets. For the moon to go in front of a planet and for the planet itself to be bright enough for us to see it in the first place, much less it being obscured, is what's so unusual. Because you've got Mars, Venus, Jupiter, those are really the planets that we can see with our naked eye.
And so why are we hearing about this now?
Well, like Michelle Nichols said at the Adler, you know, telescope sales went through the roof during COVID and the pandemic, and a lot more people became interested in what they could do, which was look up at the sky versus what they couldn't do. And so that has kind of a residual effect of COVID. People started paying more attention to nature and more attention to weird things like occultations that have been there all along. We just are noticing them now.
New to us. All right, Well, let's hope that this gray, overcast sky lifts in time.
You wait two more years. We can't see it tonight. January 2025. Mark your calendar and cross our fingers and pray to the weather gods.
All right, well, let's
get... We can see one then.
Just for a bunch of other reasons, get this overcast out of here. It's been
yes.
way too overcast.
Yes.
All right, Patty Whitley, occultation happening tonight.
Yes.
And then in 2 years. Thanks for
It's happening whether we see it or not.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And you can read Patty's full story on our website. That's WTTW.com/news. And up next, we take you inside a little village church to show you a boxing club for kids. So please stay with us.
Coverage of science and technology on Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Joel M. Friedman, president of the Alvin H. Baum Family Fund.
And there's much more ahead on the program, including candidates for mayor looking to bump each other off the ballot. Our Spotlight Politics team weighs in. But first, a boxing gym in the basement of a local church is on a mission to provide new opportunities for neighborhood kids. Chicago Tonight's Joanna Hernandez tells us more from Little Village.
It's Friday night and Coach Gabriel Navarro is hosting an amateur boxing tournament. Boxing clubs across the country go head-to-head.
I love seeing the kids win their trophies or their belts, and, you know, I just love the smile on their face.
Navarro is a former professional boxer who is head coach at Chicago Youth Boxing Club.
I like to teach what I've learned. Half of my coaches, they were fighters here first, and now they're coaches.
During the week, the gym is a packed house for practice. Students like Elizabeth Rodriguez come after school.
What I like about being here is that you come here, you have like a family, you support each other when sparring, and you can take out your anger or like just a stress reliever.
Most of the youth participating are from the Little Village neighborhood. 15-year-old Brandon Irales says he's lost 80 pounds since joining the boxing club.
I used to get bullied a lot, and I didn't like that, so I also felt like I couldn't do things that other people could do, so I decided to come back here and lose all the weight.
Navarro says the program focuses on giving kids confidence in and out of the ring.
He will never step in the ring like a year ago.
Really, never?
No, he said he was never going to do it. He's too fat, this and that. I'm like, we could do it. And look at him now.
Chicago Youth Boxing Club started in 2006 as a refuge for young people seeking a positive outlet. Raul Acala participated in the program when he was a kid and now coaches others.
You give me different knowledge because I grew up in the street. I had friends that were in gangs, friends that were doing bad stuff. I had friends that were doing good stuff, so it was up to me to choose. And this boxing really helped me guide myself.
The boxing club is in the basement of La Villita Community Church in Little Village. Noah Pickens is the new executive director and says he has big plans for the boxing center.
We really focus a lot on the boxing, the sport itself, you know, but we also have a piece of our programming that's nutrition and health, right? And then on the third side, it'd be more like academic success and personal growth.
The team says it's getting ready to revamp programming beyond the ring. Mentor Alexis Rube is leading a tutoring program called Si Se Puede.
The vision is essentially to be able to help anyone and everyone in the community, you know, whether that's through academic support, social emotional learning, or just providing a safe space for youth to be able to be there.
And some compete in tournaments like this in hopes to be good enough to go pro.
A lot of them, you know, come in and they're nationally ranked or they're hoping to get nationally ranked, and all that opens doors for the possibilities of what it is that someone may want to do, whether it's in boxing or in something else.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
The Boxing Center is open Monday through Friday from 3 to 9 p.m. To learn more about the club, you can visit our website, WTTW.com/news. Still to come on Chicago Tonight, who's in and who could be knocked off the ballot in the crowded race for Chicago mayor? Comedian and Southsider Pat McGann on forging a career in stand-up and his upcoming gig at the iconic Chicago Theater. And we introduce you to the newest guest conductor for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. But first, some more of today's top stories. Community members are voicing their concerns over the Chicago Police Department's proposed new gang database system. The Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability is questioning, quote, the purpose and need for it, the circumstances in which this type of information is collected, who can access and use this type of information, and how people will learn that they have been included so that they can contest that decision if they so choose. CDP's proposed system comes more than 3.5 years after the city's watchdog warned the records were riddled with errors ripe for abuse and disproportionately targeted Black and Latino Chicagoans. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth tests positive for COVID-19. Duckworth says she's fully vaccinated, double boosted, and will remain in isolation until further notice. In a statement, the senator says, quote, my symptoms remain mild. I cannot encourage my fellow Americans more strongly to get vaccinated and continue getting your boosters as advised by medical professionals across the country and around the globe. More money for small business owners in Illinois. The state is set to receive more than $350 million in federal funding to help struggling small businesses as part of the American Rescue Plan. According to the governor's office, the goal is to help business owners attract more capital investment and expand or launch business operations. Illinois will be distributing the money through 4 different equity and low-interest loan programs in the coming months. Paris.
Thanks, Brandis. Our next guest is a former retail packaging salesperson from the South Side who ventured into the world of stand-up at the tender age of 31 years old. And since then, Pat McGann's career has taken him from comedy clubs to theaters to an iTunes special, and in a few months, he'll be making his headlining debut at the Chicago Theater. Here's a brief clip from his appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
So I'm happy to be here. Just good to be out, right? Just good to be out. Got kids at home. My wife and I have 3. 3 under 4. Yeah, that's how people react. Some people ask me what it's like. Here's a fast fact. 75% of the asses I wipe aren't mine.
Good thing to know. Joining us is comedian Pat McGann. Pat, good to see you again.
Good to see you. I love the intro. That's how I'm brought on stage all the time.
Right, this is how we're setting you up. You know, you mine so much of your comedy from your life as a father of 3. So I'm wondering, when you're changing diapers, you're feeding your kids, you're putting them to bed, is your mind constantly thinking, this is a good bit? Or how do I make a bit out of this?
Anything that bothers me usually becomes a bit. Anything that's annoying or, you know, it's usually things that you really love or really hate that you end up writing about. So it's anything in your life, really.
What are the situations with your kids, with your family, that sort of provide the most material for you?
Right now I'm talking a lot about sports and how it's been ruined by all these dads that didn't make it. It's like, why don't you guys calm down?
So they live vicariously through their kids.
Yeah. Your descendants aren't going to make it either. Can we calm down a little bit with the 80-game schedule going out of state?
All right, well, what's the worst offense you've seen from some of these dads?
You know, they just argue with each other. There's always like, who holds this kid? It's always a suspicious-looking kid. Everyone's like, who's Drago here? Where's the paperwork on this kid?
So they take it totally seriously when it's their kids that are supposed to be just having fun.
Yeah, and the kids.
So you're the fun dad then.
I'm not the fun dad, but I'm.
So you're like that too.
Now I'm not in super intense, but I'm not like, you know, I think a little bit of perspective. I like to observe it, and then, you know, I see my kid when I tell him the game's canceled and he's flossing, just like, oh, you know, dancing like no game tonight, like all happy about it. Then you know. see the absurdity of it.
What's your process from being in these situations to having a finely crafted set of this material?
Well, I mean, I think it's just repetition of living it and then trying it on stage, and then that's when you get the feedback from the audience and shape it, right? I was this weekend trying a new bit about shopping for old people because I'm trying to come up some Christmas presents for my parents. And what do you get? Old people, you know? And so you know it's over when you start getting food for a gift. Because that's what we used to do. Like, my grandma's, like, last few Christmases, it was like she's getting lobster bisque.
Or tins of pastries or sweets or something like that.
Her present's in the fridge. And you got to go get it and drag it in the living room. And then, I mean, that's the, you know, you just kind of live it and report it.
And speaking of living it, we mentioned at the top you were working in retail packaging sales until 31, until you decided to take a stab at this career. How daunting was it to enter this at the age of 31?
It was, you know, I never thought it was going to become a career, to be honest with you. But it was always something I wanted to do. I like to write. I was always filling out notebooks and coming up with ideas, and never was a stage guy, though, you know. I was playing sports as a kid. I wasn't on... in theater or on a stage in front of people. So that was the daunting part. What I did was I went to some open mics here in Chicago. You know, there's a very vibrant comedy scene in Chicago. It's known for improv in Second City, but the stand-up scene is one of the strongest in the country. And on any night, you can go out to an open mic and get the vibe, check it out, and just being there makes it more real, makes it seem a little bit more approachable, you know?
I would imagine you just absorb a whole ton when you're out there a lot. You know, recently, you're probably absorbing a lot from Sebastian Maniscalco, the local Arlington Heights native that's now a giant comedy celebrity. He produced a stand-up special of yours on iTunes. You've been touring with him. What's it been like to work with him?
It's been insane. You know, I saw the B-roll here at Zany's behind us. That's where I met Sebastian, and that's kind of where my career kind of took off. I was a house MC there, was working there a ton, and being in his orbit kind of took me out of that club atmosphere where I was doing crowd work and working on, like, my persona, really. You don't really realize you're doing it, but when I went with him, I started to build material because you can't really do crowd work in his venues. He's doing the Chicago Theater in every town. He's doing these big theaters, arenas now. It's been an insane experience. It's been unbelievable. He's really taught me a lot, really, and just by example, too. Like, he's willing to talk and listen and give me advice, but just watching him has really helped a lot.
And speaking of insane places you played, we showed that clip on Colbert. You did Letterman. Can you just tell me what it feels like the second before your name is called and you go out there in front of the studio audience, in front of millions watching on TV?
Well, the first time I did Letterman was, I was like an out-of-body experience. I was super nervous, jitters, kind of, and the guy backstage to relax me was like, hey, this is where the Beatles made their debut when they came to America.
No pressure.
Have a good time. I mean, we're at the Ed Sullivan Theater, and at that time, that was the biggest thing I'd ever done, and Letterman was like a pipe dream for me, but that was a goal, you know, to be on his show. And so, you know, definitely nervous. And then when you get out there, you get the first laugh, it relaxes you, and then it becomes obvious that it's just stand up. And really, like, you could talk yourself into it when you're off stage and out of that moment. Like, what are you nervous about? Like, people just want to laugh. Like, they don't want you to bomb. They don't want you to struggle.
They're all on your side.
Yeah, they're on your side. And they're nervous for you a little bit. So it's just kind of like, get them to relax. And but the TV audiences, you know, when David Letterman's introducing you, or you had the clip from Colbert, like, that's greases the wheels, too. Like, you already kind of have their, you know, stamp of approval. Check this guy out. Listen to him for a few minutes. So it's a really good situation.
And you still live in Chicago. You live on the South Side. You're going to make your debut at the Chicago Theater as a headliner in April. What does it mean to you to be playing this iconic theater in your hometown?
Oh, I mean, this is... It still doesn't seem very real to me. Couldn't be more excited. I've been there before. Opened for Sebastian at the theater. I did an event with the White Sox at the Chicago Theater.
I was at that show when you opened for Sebastian, by the way.
Really?
You were terrific. Yes.
Oh, thank you, Paris. I appreciate it, buddy. Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, I've walked by that theater my whole life. It's like one of the most beautiful marquees in the country. And I've seen other comics there. Been there as a, you know, consumer. So to be out there and get to perform, I'm fired up.
Do you have the material crafted that you're going to do that night?
No.
You have no idea what you're going to do?
Not really. I mean, I do have an idea. Like, I have some chunks that I've been working on the last year that are new, but I have some newer ideas as well, and things going on in my life that I need to talk about that will be in a few months a little bit different. So it'll be good, though.
Interesting. We can't wait to see it. We once had Richard Lewis on the show who said that he has no idea what he's going to talk about when he goes out, and he's completely nervous. I assume that you have kind of a game plan of what you want to do.
I introduced Richard Lewis at Zany's one night.
Did you really?
And he parks in front of the club on Wells, and you're told to go up and introduce him when the car is out front. And he walks into the club and right onto the stage. And you can't say anything other than, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Lewis.
So as soon as you hear, you know, the car, like, turn off or something like that, you have to start the intro.
And then you bring him right up.
All right. Well, Pat McGann, great seeing you again. All the best.
Thank
Congratulations
you,
on that show. And we're looking forward to it.
Appreciate it.
All right. And again, you can catch Pat McGann at the Chicago Theater in April. And up next, our Spotlight Politics team with the latest in the race for Chicago mayor. So please stay with us.
It's high-stakes season in Chicago politics where campaigns try to knock candidates off the ballot. Plus, what the Safety Act Amendment bill actually does. All that and much more in tonight's Spotlight Politics. Welcome back. Parachute's Amanda Vinicky and Heather Sharone. So we know that five candidates are facing ballot challenges in the mayoral race. Heather, is it actually possible that some of the candidates might be knocked off?
Absolutely. Every year, at least one candidate gets knocked off the ballot. I think the candidate most in danger is probably Alderman Roderick Sawyer, who did not tell reporters how many signatures he submitted, but acknowledged it had been rough. He dealt with a back injury during the petition gathering period. It will be interesting to see whether he withstands the challenge filed by Willie Wilson. Also in danger is Jamal Green, who got that coveted top spot on the ballot. And if he's removed from the ballot, Alderman Sophia King will move up to that top spot.
And Jamal Green, he was the one who was knocked off the ballot last year. I wonder how many politicos are going to start a lottery to see who does not make the ballot. Amanda, former state senator Ricky Hinden, pretty hot over the challenge to Willie Wilson's petitions. And he posted his displeasure on Facebook. Tell us more.
That he did. And this is sort of an ongoing feud between Jamal Green and Willie Wilson's camp, or at least Ricky Hinden, who is a former state senator, very flamboyant, calls himself Hollywood Hinden.
And he used to post checks on his wall of the money that he brought to his district.
He's an interesting guy. But he's working for the Willie Wilson campaign and had previously, as you noted, Brenda, succeeded in getting Jamal Green knocked off the ballot on Green's first run for mayor of Chicago. And so there's this Facebook post where he said something to the effect of, Green will not make the ballot, so there. And this kind of gets into this, I guess it feels in a way somewhat childish, and yet I also think maybe is there something sort of just human about this? Well, we talk about these figures. I mean, they are politicians, and they're going forward. It's supposed to be about policy. But you see each other. This does get personal.
The same thing happened
4 years
ago.
And this is sort of on display,
so sure. 4 years ago, Willie Wilson's campaign and Jamal Green, and in fact, they were in the hall, like, jawing at each other. It's personal.
So we know that he got the top spot, Jamal Green, facing petition challenges. I think I said he got knocked off last year. Feels like every year, doesn't it?
Right.
It was 4 years ago. But does ballot position matter a little or a lot, Paris? Because you would think in a crowded field, you take every advantage you can get.
Sure, you take every advantage you can get, but I have to think it doesn't really matter because it's going to be a low turnout election. If you're going to vote, you're a Chicago resident, you've done your homework here. You're there for one reason, really, is to vote for the next executive of the city and the next Alder person, so I think you're going to be looking for a little more than who is that name at the top. You're going to want to do your homework. I think what matters more is name recognition, and that's going to come down to who has the money to get on TV or social media or wherever the ads are going to be. And right now it looks like Chuy Garcia with that union endorsement, Paul Vallis has got a little money, and then Lori Lightfoot, who is reportedly in San Francisco right now raising money. And there's the other thing called earned media, where it's like you're on the news or you have a press conference.
On a show like Chicago.
On a show like
Chicago. Maybe.
I remember four years ago with Lightfoot, it was like the earned media that really got the ball rolling for her, especially when There was this one press conference where Preckwinkle sent a surrogate of Preckwinkle was there and getting in her face. So Lightfoot went back and started pointing in his face. And that was a moment that went viral. It went all over the news and the ball started rolling. So it's something like that that really gets your name out there. And you've only got really 3 months to do it.
And I'm sure some folks will be looking to create those moments. Heather, Mayor Lightfoot didn't even bother to jockey for the ballot position in this crowded field. What does that say?
It means that she agrees with Paris, that she's got the name recognition, and she said that she didn't need to sort of, you know, worry about whether she was first on the ballot or last on the ballot, that she was confident her supporters were going to find her on the ballot and vote for her. I should also mention that I think Brandon Johnson will also have the money and the volunteers to compete with the endorsement of the Chicago Teachers Union and the SEIU Local 73 and SEIU Healthcare Illinois. Those are sort of, I think, sort of the candidates who will be first up on air, while the other candidates will have to scramble to make those moments to sort of rise out of the middle of the pack.
And let's talk a little bit more about that, because as you've said, Jesus Chuy Garcia gets a pledge of $1 million from one labor union. The mayor is touting the union support that she's got. Heather, of course, just mentioned Brandon Johnson. Besides, you know, the crowing rights, Garcia has the money right now. Is that the main prize with union endorsements? Is it the cash?
Well, I mean, Brandis, cash doesn't vote, but it does talk, or at least help to amplify your message. So it is one of the main things. You also, of course, are looking for, especially with unions, they have a lot of members. And so if you have all those members that you believe are going to vote for you, that they're going to sort of follow the wishes of union leadership, that they are going to be campaign boosters who will do the hard work of going door to door and asking their friends, their family to do the work for you. So that is also a big part of it. It is twofold. You want the cash and you want the bodies.
Get some boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the governor quietly signing the Safety Act cleanup bill. Take a look at what he had to say about that.
Because January 1 is a date that is important in the Safety Act, every day before that we can get it signed and into law and considered, as the judges and state's attorneys effectuate it, is good for them.
So, Amanda, does this jive with him signing it behind closed doors, or is it more political?
I mean, it's difficult to ascribe any sort of motive to a politician. We didn't actually, I did ask him why he signed it, and that was his answer. I mean, in a way, yes, it makes sense that you want to get the bill signed into law right away. But also, state's attorneys are well aware of the situation. They can read. They know that he wasn't going to use his veto pen to make any sort of changes to it. So in a way, maybe that's a bit of bluster. I don't know. It kind of sounded like he had a cold there. Maybe he was just under the weather or busy, or that he didn't want to have to answer a whole lot of questions for something that he took a lot of flack for during the campaign, whereas clearly that is something, as any defenders of the Safety Act will tell you, they believe voters didn't buy, and that is why you saw Pritzker easily reelected, as well as Democrats. And so read into it what you will. But by the way, there is still a court case that is going to be heard mid this month, and so that will perhaps settle more about what is the future of the Safety Act and these major changes with bail in Illinois.
Heather, what are some of the concerns that this amendment is clearing up?
Well, it will give judges clearer instructions on sort of what offenses make somebody eligible to be held without bail, including sort of making that clear that it could be stalking and that it could be people who pose a danger to the general community. The original bill specified a threat to a specific person, and that was something that came in for a lot of criticism. It also attempts to make sure that there aren't any, isn't confusion between December 31st and January 1st when, you know, the new law goes into effect and will significantly change the way people can apply to get out of jail after they're arrested and charged with a crime. I think Amanda's right. I think we're sort of right now in a holding pattern to see what the courts do. And of course, it's not clear whether this change, this cleanup bill, so to speak, will resolve the controversy, even though it proved to be a non-factor in the gubernatorial election.
And Amanda, as we saw earlier in your report, the governor celebrating minority pot licenses today. What took so long for the social equity pot shops to open?
So long. Really, the bulk of it is lawsuits, including by those that did not win a license, or even those that won a license but wanted more, and that there were a lot of questions. I mean, so it's lawsuits, but also there were questions about the grading process for these applications in the first place. There are certainly critics that say Illinois messed up how the law was written, that they should have calibrated differently in the first place, particularly by, for example, allowing to be a factor in social equity, the hiring of people for, say, a cannabis dispensary who had been in prison or were a relative of somebody who'd been punished for pot crimes, whereas they're saying that's not true social equity. So I think that there are a lot of questions still surrounding this, and we're going to continue to keep an eye on it, in part because this really is something that Illinois continues to say, hey, look at us, we are on the forefront, where you are seeing states begin to eclipse Illinois, not just in how they're doing with marijuana, but also how they're doing in terms of social equity.
Paris, haven't forgotten about you. The governor's weighing weed delivery next. What's going on?
Tip your drivers, I guess. I mean, I think it's something that he said we'll look into. I don't think he's saying, yes, we want to do this right now. A few states have done this. Can they make money off it? Can they get tax revenue? And does it eat into the illicit market? So that's what they're going to look at. But, you know, I have to say, like, this whole industry has just exploded. The way they've, like, not only gotten legalization in all these states, but then gotten legislatures to approve these other things, like delivery and home grow and all the other stuff. And then I have to, like,
wonder, again, money talks. I mean, you're getting a lot of revenue.
The lobbying has been
sure handy for the state.
The money talks. But see, speaking of the money talks, how many of these social equity mom-and-pop shops are there going to be, though, in 3 or 4 years? Because the way this is going is, like, these big, giant companies are eating up. And if you're a mom-and-pop shop, it's too good to pass up. I mean, you're going to get millions and millions of dollars, and you don't have to have the headache of running a business. Why wouldn't you do it? So it's very quickly, this industry is turning into like an oligopolistic, just let's say, an oligopolistic market.
It's a thing.
You know, where it's
it
like Walmart and Target and all that. It's going that
big
way really fast.
Eating mom-and-pop stores,
yeah,
but in
that
this
would have
case,
been easier to say.
Including a lot based in Chicago, by the way.
Yeah.
Well,
Preston,
speaking of, so Heather, how many more and when will we see more shops open in Chicago?
Well, so that's the other side of this. Once you get the license, you have to go through the permitting process. And in Chicago, that involves going before something called the Zoning Board of Appeals, which can take a long time because you have to meet all of the requirements. You have to be a certain distance away from schools and other sensitive uses. So it has not been an easy process to actually get open in Chicago, which is another reason why you're seeing some of these smaller, you know, operations who won these licenses sort of selling them off, because it has been so difficult and so expensive to get those doors open. And sure, you're making a lot of money once those doors open, but it has not been by any stretch of the imagination a smooth road to get to that point.
So the Illinois House, we know, is weighing legislation restricting assault weapons. Amanda, they go back into session in January before the new legislature is sworn in. Is there support for these restrictions?
So you have had some Republicans even endorse this deal. For example, the former House Republican leader Jim Durkin had talked about calling for assault weapons. This bill, however, does more than just that, including raising the age of that you could get a state license to own and to purchase a gun. So I think there's going to be a lot of heavy negotiating. There are going to be some Democrats, particularly those in downstate territories. There aren't many of them left, granted, who are going to have a hard time with this. But I do expect that it is going to be something that gets pushed, goes forward, because Pritzker needs it too. He campaigned on this. We've talked on Spotlight previously about his having maybe his sights set higher on sort of federal position. He's campaigned on this nationally as well, made this a deal. So he needs it to happen sooner than later.
There's momentum, but as you mentioned, it's a huge feather in your cap if you indeed are thinking of running for president in a Democratic primary.
Well, in Paris, the Democrats, you know, add to their supermajority in the next legislature. Are they likely to have better luck with passage there?
I would think they would have better luck. And like I said, there is momentum. And typically, it's not been a Democrat-Republican thing. It's been upstate versus downstate. Downstate Democrats in the past are gun owners, and they don't want these kinds of restrictions. But as Amanda just mentioned, there are upstate Republicans that are for this. So it does seem like they do have momentum and numbers to potentially get it done, but
again,
we shouldn't predict anything.
Legal challenges, even if it gets passed, not the end of the story.
The gun lobby has lots of resources to do that, the Illinois Rifle Association and the National Rifle Association.
We can count on it, I'm sure. Heather, a little bit of national news. Congressional gold medals were handed out yesterday for the heroism demonstrated during the January 6th insurrection, but one family snubbed GOP leaders at that event. Tell us what happened.
Well, this was the family of Officer Brian Sicknick, who died 24 hours after the insurrection, and his family was awarded his gold medal posthumously. And after shaking the hands of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, they very pointedly did not shake hands with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and potentially soon-to-be House Speaker Kevin McCarthy after the first of the year and Republicans have the majority. Brian Sicknick's mother told CNN, saying that she wanted to make a point that she thought the Republicans had really thwarted an investigation into what happened in January 6th, and that they had made sort of any sort of healing possibility harder by continuing to embrace former President Donald Trump, whose, of course, supporters were responsible for that violence.
Wow. Paris, we've got about 30 seconds left. January 6th committee making criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. Could the former president be named?
I would assume. I mean, the whole point of this and the whole storyline that's come out from these hearings is that there was one ringleader for this, and that is Donald Trump. And there were all these underling players that were part of these alleged schemes. But it wouldn't have happened without Donald Trump, who also faces all these other criminal investigations, federal and state, and now the special prosecutor who is looking into all of that. So this will perhaps become part of the special prosecutor's case.
Okay. Just dying to see what happens with all of that. Obviously, Paris Schatz, Amanda Vinicky, Heather Sharone, thanks to all of you for Spotlight.
Thank you.
Up next, a big debut with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. But first, a look at the weather.
A Finnish-Ukrainian conductor is making her Chicago Symphony Orchestra debut this week with a diverse repertoire of compositions she says reflect her love for the craft. Arts correspondent Angel Ito introduces us to the CSO's newest guest conductor.
Dalia Saskavska has loved music since she was a child. It wasn't until her introduction to classical music by a teacher at 12 years old that she realized she discovered a lifelong passion.
She gave me a CD with opera, Madame Butterfly by Puccini, and it blew my mind. Really, it changed my life. Ever since I became like really addicted to orchestra music and to opera, I started to lend scores from the library and play, for example, Beethoven symphonies, like all the parts. I was so obsessed with orchestra playing and the sound that they produced.
Staszewska's love for these sounds have taken her around the world, from chamber orchestras to philharmonic orchestras. No matter the number of musicians, she's always followed her love for music.
I've been always a very social person, and I enjoyed a lot of playing together and just meeting your friends and sharing great time together, and also that it's not only me doing the sound, but everybody has like own function. It's like a building a house.
She's taking that thrill to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra this weekend in a 3-night-only concert as a guest conductor.
I wanted to take as a main work piece that is really dear to me, Bartok, Concerto for Orchestra. And I think that I'm quite deeply connected also to Hungarian music, so this is something that I feel really at home conducting. I'm immensely grateful to conductors like Susanna Malki and Marin Alpsop. I can be myself because of them. And of course, I wanted to make it even easier for the future generations. And I want girls to see that this is becoming a conductor is a career.
How do you hope your love for music will resonate with the audiences that you're playing for?
Every time I come to an orchestra, I'm just myself. And I hope this also shines to the audiences that are coming to watch the concerts, my love to music and what I want to share through music. And it's the same thing for the audiences. Just come as you are. You know, you don't need the necessary to understand music. It, you know, just let it come to you.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Eden.
And you can see Dalia Stasevska at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra tomorrow through Saturday. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news.
You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And please join us tomorrow night live at 7. U.S. Attorney John Lausch talks recent cases, convictions, and what's next.
Plus, how one North Lawndale resident is bringing holiday cheer to the neighborhood. We have a live report. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and good evening.
Closed captioning is made possible in part by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.